Johnny, are you ready to go off the record? On the record, and that with the great managing partner of the law firm, Campola Middleton McCormick, his name, Joseph Nicholas Campola. And we welcome him in his usual spot right here on LI News Radio. Kind of a shortened version today, but we'll get in as many topics as we can, Mr. Campola. How are you, sir?
I'm doing terrific, and I appreciate you accommodating my schedule. I have to be at Hofstra for a Long Island Regional Planning Committee meeting for the HIALI. So a lot of good stuff going on there. We can talk about that next time, all the exciting stuff going on there, but I appreciate you accommodating me.
Listen, for whatever accommodations are needed when it comes to Joseph Campola, we are there to do what we have to do right here on the station. So not an issue.
That's really
at all.
Nice. Yeah, I really appreciate that. That's really nice.
No, no problem. Listen, let's get into some stuff. You know, this whole Jeffrey Epstein, Joe, I remember many years ago where the Manhattan DA's office had pretty gruesome evidence against this pedophile billionaire. I mean, his depravity and everything else, a prosecutor, and I remember this vividly like it was yesterday, a prosecutor inexplicably to me argued for leniency. This was during a sex offender registry hearing. I mean, it's unbelievable what has transpired since and how this thing is not behind bars, and we're talking about him. It's Alex Acosta and everything else. It's just an amazing turn of events in 7 or 8 years that have transpired for this guy to be still out there.
I got to tell you, Jay, every day I'm fascinated with the new depth of this story that, you know, that come out. So he's prosecuted, years ago. He does time, but, you know, while he's doing time, he's able to be released for 12 hours a day to go to his private office. He gets out of serving time, and he's able to lobby the Manhattan DA's office to get his sex offender status lowered so that he'd be able to, you know, do international travel and not have to check in as frequently as he would need to do, which we don't really understand. His plane was called Lolita Express. Everybody openly called it the Lolita Express and joked around about it. Everybody talked openly about how he liked young girls. He talked openly about how he liked young girls. He had an island somewhere that they called Pedophile Island. That was what the locals all called it. In his mansion, he has a trophy room with nude young girls, pictures of nude young girls hanging in him in a massage table, which is called the trophy room, which apparently he showed off to everybody when they visited his mansion in Manhattan. And yet, notwithstanding all of that, presidents and princes and prominent newscasters and actors and actresses all hung out with this guy, all visited this guy, all did business with this guy. It's such a weird story to me. I don't understand how something like that happens. I really don't. It's fascinating to me. It's terribly, terribly, horribly tragic for all of these young girls. I mean, there's going to be hundreds and hundreds of these young girls. He set up a scheme where he'd pay them cash and then he'd pay them a bonus if they recruited new young friends to come. I mean, of course, these are all allegations, but they just seem so incredibly credible at this point that I don't know what the defenses can be, particularly because of his past conviction. And he's got some pretty big fish caught up in this web of his. I mean, this net that they're pulling up, there's some pretty big names that have been on these planes and at these places. So I don't think we've seen the end of it. It's really, really sad and tragic to me that it got this far. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence, but I think the real outrage is going to come, Jay, if he got out, he got that slap on the wrist for his terrible crimes, all of which have you know, wrapped in and snared up Secretary of Labor Acosta. But he got a slap on the wrist. I don't know if there have been other girls since he's been released that have been sexually abused by him. That's where there's going to be really big trouble is, you know, if it's past crimes and he did a light sentence, but he did a sentence and he didn't commit any other violations, that's one set of issues that we as a society need to deal with, right? Is how did he get away with such a light sentence and why did he get such preferential treatment? But if it's that he got away with a light sentence and preferential treatment and then everybody overlooked him getting out and him continuing to assault children, then that's going to be a huge issue because that just means we let a predator out and he continued to prey and nobody gave a damn about making sure those kids were safe going forward. And so I haven't read anything yet about there being any victims that have come forward post his release from prison, but I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to hear about that soon. I mean, according to the FBI, they got thousands of pictures of nude young girls cataloged, and they busted into one of his safes, and it was cataloged by categories with handwritten notes on it, and he has this weird black book where he allegedly kept notes of all the people who visited him and what their preferences were in girls. It's like a really crazy dark web movie or book that we're reading, but it really happened. And with some of the most prominent names attached to it, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, Alan Dershowitz, I mean, Ken Starr. I mean, the names that are attached to this story are unbelievable, that if true, this could have all happened with those big names sitting right there watching it happen. So I think there's a lot more to go on this story.
Thank you. This is an egregious dropping of the ball by our justice system. You know, considering these girls, Joe, 14 to 17, recruited, paid, sexual favors to Epstein. Prosecutors were aware the state board assigned Epstein a risk assessment. I think the number, if I recollect correctly, was 130. That's a number that is above the qualifying number for level three. I think it's 110. I mean, think about that. I mean, it's unbelievable. And yet you had individuals that argued that he should have been labeled a level one offender. You know, the least restrictive, which would have kept him off the online database, by the way. You know, to me, with all that went on going back in the years, you know, I mean, you look at everything with Vance's office in Manhattan, Cyrus Vance, Jennifer Gaffney, and everything else. I mean, just a terrible job here. The system somehow, you know, really missed the boat on this guy. This guy should have been locked up way back in time. It shouldn't even be an issue at this point. With everything that transpired.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I've been following just as closely. I've been following sort of the politics about the prosecutor. And I can certainly understand the optics, for Secretary of Labor Acosta are not good at this point, because he was the federal prosecutor that declined to prosecute him. But I think if you read more deeply into what actually transpired, it's not really that simple. You know, federal prosecutors, a lot of the time, will use the threat of federal prosecution as leverage if they feel that the state or the county's district attorneys or state prosecutors are not being tough enough on what's being charged, right? And so that's what sort of happened in this way, at least from the articles I've been reading across multiple newspapers and reporting sources, is, you know, initially it was a joke. Initially they were going to let this guy go with probation. They weren't, the state wasn't going to charge him aggressively at all. And it wasn't until the federal prosecutors and Acosta's office got involved that they decided that he needed to do jail time. And because of that, they shelved the federal indictment. Now, that's pretty common. That's not rare. That's pretty commonly done where feds will, you know, will be able to lever that. And then they feel if the state's treating it appropriately and the punishments, appropriate, that the feds aren't going to pursue it. But what happened here is after that, you know, after all that nonsense, after all that rigmarole, and because the guy just can't, you know, help himself, and he's so high profile, and all these rumors kept coming out about his plane and his island, the feds looked back into him, and now they're coming at him with all things loaded. It's really the Manhattan prosecutor's office, I think, and you know, it's funny how the New York Times will highlight, you know, the Trump nominee, but they won't talk about the Democrat Manhattan DA's office, but it's really Manhattan DA's office that downgraded him and sort of played politics. And I think that Manhattan DA's office plays politics a lot, Jay. I don't really like what I see coming out of it. They played politics with this Epstein matter. I didn't like that. I didn't like the way they played politics with Paul Manafort either, who had been charged and convicted on the federal crimes. And then they charged him with state crimes. They conjured up state crimes and charged him with that to make him pardon proof. That to me is just pure politics. I don't like when I think prosecutors are playing politics. And there's a whiff coming out of that Manhattan DA's office now that just doesn't seem right to me as an attorney. That they're looking to do those types of things. So I think they need to straighten themselves out a little bit and get their ducks in a row on this one as well.
I agree with you. And considering everything that I read from 2011 with Epstein and everything else, like I said, just a complete botching of material and everything else regarding the registry. I said it's a terrible job. We'll see what transpires. Joe, let's move to another big story. It happened on the last day or so regarding, who else? When it comes to the world of politics, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with her war of words of continuance with the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and really calling out the Speaker outright disrespectful, criticizing women of color. You know, I tell you one thing, it's tough to take all the time. Ocasio-Cortez and her friends, Ilhan Omar and company, very tough to take. Damsel in distress, crocodile tears. I can't take it anymore. I really can't. Every time a story involves Ocasio-Cortez, I cringe. You know, this is the very thing that has, in my opinion, disrupted the political landscape. Ever since her big win, I get it. I give her a lot of credit, but she has been an absolute disaster. Listen, she has fought hard and vehemently on certain issues, but at other times, she has proved to be just a distraction. The tweets and everything else, I can't. Listen, I know the president does the same thing with the tweets. Ocasio-Cortez is completely off the rails when it comes to these tweets sometimes, and especially these confrontations.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny, Jay, because friends of mine who are conservative say, you know, I thought there wasn't anybody I could hate more than Nancy Pelosi in politics until Ocasio-Cortez, you know, came along. She makes Nancy Pelosi look practical, pragmatic, and a moderate, which is what I find, you know, funny about the whole thing. I think Nancy Pelosi is right in this. Look, Ocasio-Cortez, I certainly appreciate her energy. I appreciate her enthusiasm. I know she has a district that she has to support in her district. You know, is a much different district than exists out here in Suffolk County. I think her policy is terrible because just the way she rallied against Amazon coming into her district and not understanding how that was actually going to economically help her district. I think that's what made Nancy Pelosi draw the line in the sand, don't you think? People have to understand, Nancy Pelosi would love nothing more than to be supporting, you know, Ocasio-Cortez and her squad, the four of them, in Congress there, that are young, progressive millennials with big, bold ideas. She'd love to support them if she could, okay? But you said it, and I think it's right. They're very Trump-like insofar as they're very erratic with their tweets. They don't think through their policy plans. And Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, she has to get votes for things that can actually pass and that can pass muster in moderate districts. You know, there's a lot of congressional races up this year, presidential term, 2020. It's going to be a huge congressional race in the country, so much at stake. And a lot of these Democratic Congress people were moderates that were able to win because of a Trump backlash. And so Nancy Pelosi, being a smart, practical woman that she is, isn't going to let four apples spoil the bunch, and she said so. And I thought it was very incredibly bold. Apparently she got a standing ovation in her private caucus when she came out against them, because I'm sure there's a lot of frustration in the Democratic Party right now with those tweets. The same way, when Trump tweets out his erratic stuff, the Republican caucus cringes because they're not really sure how they're going to handle that in their moderate districts. And it's the moderates right now that are that are going to struggle in Congress because they're the ones who have to get reelected in their districts. So, hats off to Nancy Pelosi. Again, I don't really care If young congressmen and congresswomen want to be bold in their statements and everything else, I don't really care. I think we do need some fresh ideas and some fresh blood. But I also think as a country, and I think this is what Nancy Pelosi says, as a country, we need to get ideas that people can get behind and she can get majority votes enacted in. You can't just keep throwing these crazy ideas with no plan, no way to pay for them up against the wall, and then call out leadership for not supporting them. That's not the way Congress works. So hopefully they'll learn and they'll grow and they'll find ways to get support for their bills, and they'll find ways to get bipartisan support for their bills, the younger Congress folks, and hopefully that enthusiasm will grow. But I it's one of those things where I just sort of kick back, grab some popcorn, and watch the news or read the paper and chuckle, because I think Nancy Pelosi is doing a good job trying to keep that Democratic Congress in line.
Listen, I'm with you. I rarely do I give Pelosi credit, no doubt, but this on her side, I mean, to me, this is the modern version of Mean Girls, okay? This is in the political landscape. You know, this is Mean Girls, Joe, what you're looking at here. You're between Ocasio-Cortez and who else? Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, and Ayanna Pressley. That's this yep. year's version, the modern version of Mean Girls in the political landscape. By the way, all freshman House members who voted against the $4.5 billion bill last month. Let's put that into context as well. I'll tell you, tough to take sometimes what's going on, but you know, that's it. Pelosi, you know, when have I actually been on the side of Nancy Pelosi lately? I mean, it's unbelievable, but certainly true there. So,
she made a great point, Jay, in terms of, you know, AOC has whatever she has, 4 million followers on Twitter or whatever, but she has one vote in Congress, right? So I think that a lot of people get starstruck by their followers on Twitter and they think from a national perspective, and she has a platform. So she can talk to her Twitter followers all she wants about her big, bold ideas and listen to what they are. But in Congress, she has one vote. And I think that's what Speaker Pelosi's point was. You have one vote. The four of you have four votes. You know, and we have 450-plus members here that I got to get a majority of. So let's keep that in check as we move forward. And we're not pandering to Twitter here. We're trying to get votes passed in the House of Representatives. So very practical, good, wise advice for young people who actually want to be politicians. Now, if they want to be Kardashians and they want to just get on Twitter and be as popular as possible and get a sitcom someday, then fine, then follow Twitter. But if you want to be effective legislators and practical politicians, and you got to be able to get votes to pass the things that you need to do.
No doubt, Joe Campolo, off the record, on the record. Joe, time for one more, and that, you know, let's delve into the world of the Affordable Care Act. This has been controversial beyond, you know, listen, when we watched those debates a couple of weeks ago, I didn't hear a lot of solutions as far as how to fix it. That was a big question. You know, the 10 candidates on the stage with their hands up in the air when asked whether they would cover illegal immigrants and everything else, this has been a hot topic right now. Supreme Court and everything else involved, Court of Appeals. But in essence, this is a topic not going away at all.
Yeah, so let me give a little color on this, Jay. So if you roll the tapes back, when the United States Supreme Court took up whether the Affordable Care Act was constitutional or not, right, the main challenge that was brought against the constitutionality of it was that it required people, it forced people to pay for health care. You know, if you weren't insured, you needed to go on one of these exchanges and become insured. And if you didn't, you were taxed. There was a penalty on your tax returns. And a lot of conservatives and Republicans got very mad at Chief Justice John Roberts when he voted to uphold the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. And he did so because he said Congress has the power to levy a tax. Very clear in the Constitution that Congress has the power to levy a tax. And because the penalty is taxed and assessed as part of your tax return, right, that's certainly within Congress's purview to do so. And that was like a backdoor way of him basically saying the Supreme Court's not going to be responsible for health care in this country. It's a congressional issue. The Congress needs to figure out how to fix this, and we're not going to be the scapegoats, and the Supreme Court's not going to be the ones who undid health care here in our country. And it was a move that I thought was pretty brilliant. I don't know whether the ACA is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not that deeply entrenched into healthcare, but it was a move that that certainly got the court out of a pickle. Well, Donald Trump's team comes in, and again, this is another brilliant political move. Donald Trump's team comes in, and his legal eagles look at it, and they say, "Oh, okay. John Roberts voted to uphold it because of the taxing powers. He didn't think that they had the right to force people to do it, but it was the taxing power. So now we're going to remove the tax penalty. Now there's no longer going to be a tax penalty in the Affordable Care Act. The penalty is zero. So there's no more tax argument. So new lawsuit happened, and a federal judge says, you're absolutely right. There is no tax implication, and therefore the ACA is unconstitutional. Goes up to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and it looks like now the Circuit Court of Appeals is going to agree with the lower court that there's no tax protection for Congress to have enacted this, and therefore Congress can't force people to go out and get insurance. You know, they can't force me to drive a car. They can't force me to do other things. Why should they be able to force me to get health insurance? So that's the argument that's going to go before the United States Supreme Court, it looks like. And if that's the case, with no tax penalty, you know, 99% of the experts out there say ACA is dead. You know, the Supreme Court is not going to uphold the ACA without the tax implications. So now Congress has a real hot potato, and I got to tell you, President Trump has a real hot potato, because that's the way it looks like. And, you know, the old saying, be careful what you ask for, you might actually get it. Now if the ACA collapses after all these years of having been enacted, we have no idea what that means for healthcare. And nobody's coming forward with a plan about what to do and how to do it. So, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services and all these folks out there need to be working hard. And I'm sure they are behind the scenes. I'm sure the bureaucrats behind the scenes are working hard on it. But I haven't seen, and I totally agree with you, and it's a little disappointing, I have not seen any Democrat. And the winning Democrat, Jay, the winning Democrat is going to be the one, okay, of one of the top five. There's five of them out there now that are floating around. The Democrat is going to get the nomination as the one that's going to come out with the most practical, comprehensive way to fix health care in light of what the Supreme Court is ultimately going to wind up doing, which is invalidating the ACA. But nobody's talking about it, and it's incredibly, incredibly frustrating.
It really is. It's unbelievable. We'll see what happens. But, you watch those debates. You know, one of the things I look for when I watch these Democrats going at it on two nights, the JV and the varsity, you know, I need to see some sort of solution. You don't like what's happening, give me your take on how you'd fix it. I don't get a lot of that. Don't give me free health care and everything else. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear the Bernie Sanders diatribe. You know, enough of that. You know, I want to hear some you know, resolving instances of how to fix problems here. It's unbelievable. Joe Campo, a couple of minutes. Joe's got to hit the Hofstra. Joe, let's get into a couple of things with the firm. You know, I tell you, every time I hear about Westbury, he's doing great. You got the ribbon cutting and everything else, joined by the Chamber. Talk about that.
Yeah, so hats off to the Westbury Chamber of Commerce. They are incredibly welcoming for new businesses that go into their district. We had a grand opening party. The chamber members all came. We did a fun ribbon cutting with cocktails and wine and hors d'oeuvres, and they're just great, great people. And really hats off to the Chamber of Commerce. Really proactive. I've been dealing with Chambers of Commerce my entire career, and they're all great. But Westbury really did a terrific job welcoming us, Jay, and going above and beyond being there to make us feel like a welcome part of the community. So our hats go off to them for what was a really, really fun event.
Absolutely. And as always, the great CMM cares. You got the bowling and everything else. Big networking event on the 30th of the month, supporting Family Service League, right? That's a good deal.
Yeah, so we're doing a bowling contest. We've invited all our corporate friends out there and partners to come have a night of fun with bowling and beer and wings and and a tournament, and you know, all the profits from the evening are going to be donated to the through CMM Cares to the Family Service League. But it's really a night of fun, and we've been getting such a great response from our corporate friends and partners out there, Jay, that it's so good to see how many people are willing to give back here on Long Island.
And you can visit the site, check it all out to register, cmmllp.com. It's July 30th. It's a great night, fun night, 7389100, 631-7389100. And as if Campolo doesn't have enough on his plate, how about Joe's new role, from what I hear, as a board member of the Guide Dog Foundation, America's Vet Dogs? Joe, I mean, is there enough time in the day? I mean, my goodness, you're all over the place here.
You know, there's not, but I got to tell you, Jay, when you look at the work that the Guide Dog Foundation, America's Vet Dogs, is doing, it's absolutely such important, critical work. You know, as a veteran myself, and you and I have talked for years about the shoddy treatment that returning veterans get here in our country, which is improving. I'll say it is improving. It has improved over the years, and it's improved because of folks like you who take to the airwaves and to the newspapers and force things to change. But here, America's Vet Dogs is such an amazing organization in terms of vets that are returning with PTSD, which is such an incredibly traumatizing thing for these folks to come back with, as well as other disabilities. Just to hear their stories, Jay, and see the comfort that these dogs bring them by being there, and the protection at night, and they'll wake them up when they have terrible dreams, and they'll help turn on the lights and fetch them things and just give them comfort. It's an amazing, amazing story. And so when I was approached to support it and be a member of the board, I said, how could I not? How could I not, when these men and women every single day of their lives are over there fighting and ruining their lives? Their lives get ruined. Their relationships get ruined. Their minds get messed up. Their bodies get, you know, burned and shot and blown up. They all do that for us. How could I not volunteer some of my time to make sure that they get the right treatment when they get home? And so, incredible organizations. I'm proud to be a part of it. John Miller, the CEO, is a friend and a mentor of mine. He's a fantastic leader out there in the not-for-profit community, and so I'm looking forward to helping them out.
The great Joe Campolo, ladies and gentlemen. You will hear him in his usual spot in a couple of weeks, once again, an elongated version, and we look forward to that. Good luck in Hofstra today, my friend, and we will
Thanks, Jay.
Chat with you soon. Always a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Yep, bye-bye.